We're back with Kurt Brown here on The Paula Gordon Show. He is a poet, and he also is a person willing to explore places poets often do not go. Bill Russell?
You were talking earlier about the truthfulness of science and the semi-permanent condition. But a lot of scientists, a lot of good scientists will say that the knowledge we have is provisional knowledge, that it's what we think we know absolutely today. Most people, most good scientists, I think, are open-minded about it and understand that this is only a one way. It's sort of the Indians and the camel or the elephant or whichever the story is.
Seeing the different parts of the elephant by looking at the trunk of the leg.
Listening to you talk about it reminds me of Bill Calvin, who is a neurophysiologist or something close to that, who said to us that Darwin evolution is as fundamental, he believes, to a fundamental of force in the universe as chemical bonding. Mm-hmm.
And now, chemical bonding is pretty big.
It's pretty basic. That's how we get us and all these other things. Mm-hmm. But it's what he's saying, and I think it goes to what we were talking about earlier, this constant evolution, the evolution of ideas, the stories, and all of it has the characteristic of being dynamic. It changes.
Yes, I think the sense that science, that today's science, has found everything or most things and explained it and will explain everything in the future is probably a layman's feeling about scientists. I don't think that's the way scientists feel about scientists. And Alison Hawthorne Deming in this book says that. She says, when scientists get up at a news conference and say something truthful, like they're asked a question, they say, well, actually, we don't know the answer to that yet. When they seem uncertain, people have to understand that what scientists love is the unknown. That's where they're going. That's where they want to go, right to that, to all the time. They're living in the unknown and going to the unknown. So I understand that. I think in that sense,
isn't that what a poet does?
That's what I was going to say. That in some sense, that's one of the things that scientists and poets might share is that poets are always trying to do that with their work. They do not sit down with an idea, basically that they have, that they know what they want to say. As Robert Frost said, no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader. If you are not surprised yourself at what you discover, at what you say in your poem, I think it was W.H. Auden who said, how do I know what I think till I see what I say? Right? So you're sitting down to write a poem not knowing what you're going to write. So poets, too, are always looking for, always trying to go to the unknown and see what they can find there.
Let me just plug the book here. You're talking about a book that is simply mind-bending, that you have put together, The Measured Word on Poetry and Science. And I must say, I read a lot of books, but this one just stopped me in my tracks for its beauty, for its sweep, for its ability to ask new questions and provide new answers. So this, the Measured Word, your work as a poet, also as an editor, in bringing these worlds together and pushing them apart, it is spectacular. And I'm sorry, Bill, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I am so impressed with The Measured Word and the ability of a poet to bring poets and
thanks. If I could just say a word about the books, there's a Measured Word, which are essays about science and poetry, and then Verse and Universe, which is an anthology of poems about science and mathematics. These two books came about. I've done many other anthologies on other themes that have to do with things that you would consider more literary, things that you would expect. But these two, but when I wanted to put together another anthology, I thought, what would be the least thing, the last thing that you think poets would deal with? The very last thing. And I thought, science and mathematics. And I started to think, how many poets are out there who are paying attention to science? How much have they written? And I found, in fact, there was a vast amount of work that's been done by poets who are paying attention to science and more or less know about science. They're still laymen. I mean, they're still poets. They're not scientists. And what's in these books is not science, but it is it's responding to science, and it's using some vocabulary from science and concepts and metaphors from science.
Well, and you know, going back to Aristotle and then Galileo and then the Enlightenment, science is part of the world we inhabit increasingly, and it's part of the language we use, and it would not be surprising that poets would be using that language. It's also not surprising that they don't use that exclusively, because there are lots of other things going on.
Of course, when we're talking about the past and ancient times, medieval times, there was no split between science and literature. Aristotle was a poet. He wrote poetry. So did Da Vinci. So did Galileo. In fact, when Galileo was kept from his theories about the sun and the universe because the church didn't want him to pursue it any further, he had about a 10-year period, I believe, when he wrote poetry for that 10 years before he could go back to his work, because that particular pope died and another pope who was more amenable to him continuing his work came in, and he went back to the science. But for a long time he wrote poetry. This continued throughout the 19th century. Some of the romantic poets, Byron and Poe and so forth, were very interested in science and actually carried on scientific experiments.
Well, and the classic example is Mary Shelley with Frankenstein.
Exactly. But the split began to occur, that split that C.P. Snow talks about in his famous essay in 1956, I think it was, between the two cultures, science and humanities, science and literature. That split started, and then became wider and wider, and that's what I'm trying to see. Well, maybe that isn't so split as we think, and maybe there are some similarities. Of course, there are vast differences between science and poetry and literature, and there should be. They deal with different things. They deal with those things in different ways. They can't be the same thing. They are different, but there are some similarities too. Interesting similarities.
You mentioned ontogeny and phylogeny. In a sense,
my two favorite cousins.
In a sense, that split, you know, sort of looks like a child trying to sort of define itself vis-a-vis the parents or the world around it. That the scientist felt obligated to go out by, you know, because it was still, we tend to think in very short terms, and the species goes back 200,000 years, and we've been sort of we've been telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, some people would say for 60 or 70,000 years based on language. Others would tell you probably preceding that the Neanderthals were telling stories. But that storytelling, again, is an integral, important part of how we define ourselves and how we define our relationship to the world around us and to the people around us, the other, well, animals around us.
Yeah, it's we will always be telling stories. That's why I don't worry about news that I hear every once in a while that novels are dead and poetry is dead and the theater is dead. It's just that will only occur when the race is dead, finally. We will tell stories, and we'll tell them, and we may find new ways to tell them. We might find new means, new media, but we will be telling stories.
You talk about hypertext, for instance, mm-hmm. as a new-ish. It isn't probably very new, but technologically it is a new way to tell stories, where you can branch, where there's a different way of, do you want this way? And then you go down that trail. The notion of hypertext as a way to be poetic interested me. Did you know that before you collected the essays?
No, I didn't. Stephanie Strickland, who wrote the essay in here called Seven League Boots, is someone who is studying this and paying close attention to how the computer now will impact literature and writing. And so I learned something about that. I still haven't done a lot of hypertext on the computer, but it interests me because I see she's talking about something that other poets would talk about it in a different way. They would. Robert Bly, who's coming here to read soon, talks about it as leaping. When the mind makes a leap from one subject to another subject, apparently with no connection, and yet there is the mind brings that together, and that's in a sense what hypertext seems to be doing. That you can configure it this way, and then you can change things around and read it another way, and get a different meaning from it. So that's what's going on, I think. The hypertext.
Well, and it's, I mean, in some ways, it's it's sort of an enhancement of what happens in any case. I think we all experience, if you go back and read something you've read before, mm-hmm. even a week earlier, much less decades or years later, it's a different experience.
Well,
because you bring a different, you're a different person experiencing that again.
And then there's the classic Rashomon, the movie that yeah. shows everybody sees the same thing differently.
Magnificent Seven, actually.
Well, same movie, different actors.
That's right. Well, it's interesting you say that. You know, this summer, I just reread Moby Dick, and I hadn't read it since high school. Boy, was it a different experience this time. It was just an amazingly different experience, because now with an adult with a lifetime of experiences behind both life experiences and reading experience and experience with literature and with writing, it was completely different. It was a universe to me, to use her word again for the day. It was a universe to me.
This is Kurt Brown, and I'm going to interrupt Bill Russell before I have to interrupt Bill Russell. We'll be back in a moment with Kurt Brown, a poet, an editor, a Renaissance man in his own right. Please be with us when we return in a moment with The Paula Gordon Show.